healthcare is complicated. It's boring. I don't want to talk about it. The details are confusing. And that's what these guys are relying on. They're counting on you to be so overwhelmed with all the information, you just trust them to take care of you. But they're not taking care of you. They're taking care of the people who give them money, like insurance companies. And we're all just looking at our Instagram accounts and liking things while they're voting on whether people can afford to keep their children alive or not.
Jimmy Kimmel on a tear this week against the latest effort by Senate Republicans to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. After their big failure in July, Republicans have been trying again with the Graham Cassidy bill now up for consideration. But today, John McCain gave another thumbs down. Is that the end of that? We'll discuss that. We'll also talk about Trump at the UN, the insults he's trading with North Korea, Paul Manafort, Robert Mueller. So much is going on. Josh Barrow is senior editor at Business Insider and host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Great, thanks. And Indira Lakshmanan is chair of journalism ethics at the Poynter Institute, also a columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome back to you.
Hi, Madeline.
Josh, let's start with health care with John McCain's big thumbs down. What does this mean for the future of this bill?
I think it probably means this bill is dead. Republicans hold 2 seats in the Senate, or 52 seats in the Senate. It's widely expected that every Democrat will vote against this. So 3 Republican no's kills this bill. Rand Paul has been telling anyone who will listen how strongly he opposes this bill and his intention to vote against it. Rand Paul even said today that the White House only wants this so that they can say they had a political victory. They don't care what's actually in the bill. So Rand's a no. John McCain is a no. And then Susan Collins, though she calls herself a lean no, everyone really widely expects that she'll vote against this. Susan Collins, who's the Republican senator from Maine, she even voted against the repeal package in 2015 that all but 2 Republicans voted for. Even when they could vote for it with the security of knowing that President Obama would veto the bill, she still voted against repeal. So given the extreme likelihood that she will also vote no, that's 3 Republican no's. That kills the bill. And then you also have a number of other Republicans who also might not have been gettable, most notably Lisa Murkowski, the senator from Alaska. Yeah. Probably she also would have opposed it.
Whose governor has come out against it? Alaska's governor.
Yes.
Okay, so Indira, does McConnell even bring it up for a vote if it looks like it'll fail next week?
Well, I can't get inside his head, that's for sure. But I think Josh's analysis is right, that at this point it looks like it's probably dead and this was being held up as the last-ditch effort. What I find so fascinating is that the president and the Republicans were so desperate to pass this that they even turned it into this thing against Jimmy Kimmel. You played that sound at the beginning of our conversation, and it's been striking to me how they focused in on him saying he's not capable or qualified to talk about health care. What I find galling about that is every American is capable and qualified to talk about health care because it affects all of us. Jimmy Kimmel, of course, has a personal situation. His own son was born prematurely, and that would be considered a pre-existing condition. I also have a son who suffered from cancer twice, but you shouldn't have to have a child who suffers from some condition to care about health care. And so I find it really striking that Cassidy himself would try to turn this around, but that's always been a winning strategy for Republicans on Capitol Hill, to turn the focus against celebrities and Hollywood and so-called perceived elites. But it seems a pretty lame strategy at this point, since everyone has a right to speak out about health care.
Yeah, Indira, Jimmy thanked John McCain on Twitter just a few moments ago. How powerful was his 3-day rant against this? How much do you think that worked to doom this bill?
Well, I think it certainly riled up the people who watch Jimmy Kimmel. I don't stay up that late at night, but plenty of people do. And, you know, I think the point he made is, I may not be a doctor, but, you know, look at all these other doctors and leading organizations, leading health insurance companies and the American Cancer Society, the Heart Association, all sorts of places staffed by expert doctors who think that the bill is terrible. And the analysis of it has also shown that something like 21 million fewer Americans would have health care under Graham Cassidy. So that this doesn't make it a great improvement over the previous bills. So, again, I think that, you know, 3 nights in a row he was talking about this. He's made it an issue, but so have many other people. It certainly brings it to the fore in popular culture, and that to me is interesting because it brings us back to a time with, you know, late-night comedy becoming such a factor in politics.
Yeah. John Stewart, welcome back.
Exactly.
All right, let's move on to the Alabama Senate runoff. That vote is on Tuesday. This is to fill Jeff Sessions' seat, and it's a man named Luther Strange versus Roy Moore. Luther Strange is Trump's candidate. He's kind of the establishment guy. Steve Bannon and the Breitbart crowd are backing Judge Roy Moore, and let's just get a sense of him in this soundbite.
Our foundation has been shaken. Crime, corruption, immorality, abortion, sodomy, sexual perversion sweep our land. When we become one nation under God again, when liberty and justice for all reigns across our land, we will be truly good again.
Okay, Josh, he is ahead in the polls, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, it's this sort of funny thing, right, where officially Luther Strange, the incumbent senator, is Donald Trump's candidate. But really, I think he's seen in this race as Mitch McConnell's candidate. Mitch McConnell, political action committees associated with Mitch McConnell have spent millions of dollars trying to prop Strange up in this race. And while the president has endorsed Luther Strange, as you note, many of the people close to the president have lined up very aggressively with Roy Moore. The website Breitbart has been pushing his candidacy very aggressively. And I think with what is happening now in the Senate with the health care bill falling apart again, that's sort of another demerit for Mitch McConnell with the Republican base, and I think is something that is likely to be helpful to put Roy Moore over the top here. Alabama is a heavily Republican state. If Roy Moore wins this primary, it's highly likely that he will win the general, although Democrats, who normally wouldn't bother with a Senate race in Alabama, are likely to put up some effort with their candidate against Roy Moore. Moore was elected Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in Alabama with just 52% of the vote against a Democrat just a couple of years ago. So I think there is some sense that there is a slight chance of beating him. But the most likely outcome if he wins this primary is that he will become a U.S. senator and be very much a thorn in Mitch McConnell's side. There are all sorts of things that individual senators can do to tie up the Senate. Roy Moore, who has been removed from the Supreme Court of Alabama twice for disobeying orders, is the sort of person who can throw a wrench into those sorts of systems. So I think it is likely that he will become a member of the U.S. Senate and that he will be a significant problem for establishment Republicans.
Well, is it something about Roy Moore that people in the state, the voters, like? Or is it the fact that Luther Strange, even though he's only been in the Senate since February, is seen as the establishment candidate?
Well, I think it's that they don't. Well, first of all, there's this backstory with Luther Strange, which is that Luther Strange was the state attorney general. He was investigating the governor, who was embroiled in a number of scandals, and the governor put Luther Strange in the Senate. It was widely seen as an effort to get Luther Strange away so that he couldn't continue the investigation. So that, there was that air of corruption mm-hmm. around it, that the idea that he was there to protect an establishment Republican rather than to serve a principal. And then I think it's part of this broader dissatisfaction that a lot of Republican base voters have, that they feel like they send these people to Washington and they don't do what they promised to do. They don't repeal Obamacare like they said they would. And so I think that there is a desire to stick it to Mitch McConnell, much in the way that nominating Donald Trump was a way to stick it to the Republican establishment.
So how much of this is a Trump versus Bannon fight, or is that just a D.C. parlor game?
I don't think it's Trump versus Bannon as such. I don't think, I certainly don't think Bannon is in there supporting Moore as an effort to get back at Trump. I think what happened is that, Trump, though he's had his difficulties with Mitch McConnell, has wanted to work with him on various things, and McConnell wanted him to endorse Strange. And I don't think, I don't think Trump necessarily has great personal enthusiasm for Roy Moore. So I think, Trump had his internal D.C. reasons for supporting Luther Strange. But people in his movement who basically want to, break things and bring in outsiders, it's obvious why they would be drawn to Moore.
OK, let's move on to North Korea. Indira, Kim Jong-un gave quite a speech today. He called President Trump a, quote, mentally deranged U.S. dotard. I don't know how to pronounce that.
I looked it up, dotard.
It's dotard. Okay. His foreign minister said Kim might test a hydrogen bomb over the Pacific. So that sounds pretty scary. Or is this just talk?
It's really scary, actually. And I have to say, I've been covering the North Korea issue for basically 20 years. I was the Boston Globe's Asia Bureau chief from 97 to 2003, and I have been to North Korea and, in Washington for many years, covering it as a problem for the Obama administration before it became a problem for the Trump administration. And this is the worst that I have seen this issue, whether it was under Kim's father or the young Kim himself. And I have seen, experts who I respect on nuclear issues and North Korea comparing it to, the highest point of tension since the Cuban Missile Crisis. So So we're talking, you know, it's been more than 50 years since there's been something this scary. And, you know, the other thing is that, remember that Kim Jong-un and his father before him played the role of kind of being the crazy man in the room, of saying all sorts of wild things, and essentially, at least by the Obama administration, being dismissed. You know, the Obama administration preferred to ignore what he said rather than match him, you know, insult for insult. And Donald Trump has definitely taken it to a different level, with calling him Rocket Man, mm-hmm. you know, calling him a madman. It's like the two of them are in some sort of playground, but it's not a playground. It's very scary. It's very real life. And it's unprecedented to see Kim Jong-un sitting in this weird library backdrop. For your listeners who haven't seen it, you know, he's got all these light green books in a cabinet behind him. He's got his glasses on. He's looking very serious. And I think the message that Kim Jong-un is trying to send is, I'm resolute and I'm a man of book learning. You know, unlike your president, Donald Trump, who he tries to, you know, insult with this dotard insult. So I think it's a very scary time. And, you know, the fact that his North Korean foreign minister came out to press at the United Nations and made that threat about the possible hydrogen bomb test in the Pacific Ocean. There's no way he could have done that had he not gotten the go-ahead from Kim Jong-un. So I think we're up for some pretty scary stuff ahead. And it doesn't look like the Trump administration has specifically thought out a way to de-escalate at this point.
So we're not even trying diplomacy at this point, or is that happening behind the scenes?
I certainly hope it's happening behind the scenes, but the president is not helping things with his comments on Twitter and his public comments and his speeches. You know, he did say that diplomacy is not dead in his UN speech. So let's hope that there's some really, you know, furious work going on trying to make diplomacy happen. I mean, part of it was that the audience for the speech was partly meant to be China. Donald Trump believes that by pressuring China, he can put this, you know, the squeeze on North Korea, since China's really North Korea's only ally and economic lifeline. But it's not entirely clear to me, you know, that message obviously cannot be heard simply by President Xi Jinping. It's heard by everybody, and that includes North Korea, which has run this hermit kingdom where Kim Jong-un is treated like a god. Mm. It's a cult-like status. So, you know, he has said this is only, Donald Trump's speech has only deepened his resolve to do whatever he's going to do, and he says quite chillingly, to the end.
All right, let's move on to Paul Manafort. He seems to be in some hot water, Josh. We found out this week that he offered to brief a Russian billionaire with close ties to the Kremlin during the campaign. So that doesn't look good for him.
No, it doesn't. But the most remarkable thing I think we've learned this week is that Paul Manafort is working on an effort to hold an independence referendum in Iraqi Kurdistan, which the U.S. is officially opposed to. Mm-hmm. The Turkish government, which is our NATO ally, they really don't want that to go forward. So he's actually, you know, he's still out there doing this work on behalf of foreign governments and foreign entities that have business before the Trump administration. But, you know, I think we're seeing so much news about the Manafort aspect of this investigation. At least a fraction of the stories about it have seemed actually like they came from Manafort's own side,
really?
Disclosing information about what the about what the interactions have been between Manafort and investigators. So I don't know whether that's, you know, there's this weird kabuki dance here, right, where people seem to think that what Robert Mueller is doing is trying to put intense pressure on Paul Manafort, trying to get him to cooperate with an investigation and do something that might be able to get to President Donald Trump himself. Manafort, I would assume, would like a presidential pardon or would like the president to take other actions to protect him. So you basically have this squeeze play on several sides here. We're trying to figure out who can get the upper hand and whether Manafort can be caused to participate. But then the other question is, you know, the statement that White House lawyer Ty Cobb sent actually to one of my it was obtained by one of my colleagues at Business Insider. It was sent to this British email scammer who's been emailing these people around Trump, pretending to be other people around Trump. And Cobb made the statement essentially that, you know, the president didn't do anything wrong. It's not going to get to him. But the investigation is going to go on for a long time because Mike Flynn and Paul Manafort have big troubles of their own. So there's that possibility. We don't necessarily know that Manafort knows anything that can bring the president down. So it might be that, you know, they find a whole bunch of stuff that Paul Manafort did, and that Paul Manafort ends up being the most significant target of the investigation.
Josh Barrow, senior editor of Business Insider, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. Catch it tonight at 7 o'clock. Indira Lakshmanan, chair of journalism ethics at the Poynter Institute and a columnist for the Boston Globe. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, how a story of a little girl trapped in the rubble of a school building in Mexico became big news, even though that girl did not exist. That story next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In Mexico, the death toll from Tuesday's earthquake has climbed to more than 270 people. Well, as the devastation unfolded this week, the story of a 12-year-old girl reportedly trapped in a collapsed school building became a media sensation.
Her name is Frida Sofia.
Se llamaba Frida Sofia.
Su nombre.
There's a little girl. She says her name is Frida and that there's two more children near her.
Scenes of rescuers frantically trying to reach the girl in time blanketed television coverage, and her story grew more elaborate. As many as five people were trapped with her. Rescuers were sending her water. They could see her tiny hand moving in the rubble. Except Frida Sofia not only was not trapped, she never existed. There is no Frida Sofia. Joining me now to talk about how the story of this little girl spun so far out of control is David Agron. He's contributing writer to The Guardian based in Mexico City. Welcome.
Good to be here.
All right. So this is a school and it is a pile of rubble. There are lots of rescuers there. 11 people were pulled out and, you know, some very dramatic imagery then on television. So how did everyone start to focus on the existence of a 12-year-old girl who is still trapped?
You know, that's a really good question, which no one really has a good answer for. You know, at the school site, there were 25 deaths. They were 19 children, 6 adults. And what started happening throughout the day on Wednesday, the day after the earthquake, is that word started spreading that there was still a girl trapped, and that some rescue worker had heard the name Frida and also had seen her wiggling her fingers, supposedly. And around 4 o'clock, there was a big cheer that went up. Word spread that there were two girls rescued. And so, you know, you started seeing this scene of people running in with stretchers and adrenaline and all sorts of medical supplies. And you know, kept waiting for this rescue. And then a couple hours later, a person that digs one of the group people. Rescuers who digs through rubble, a very well-known group in Mexico City that goes to disaster scenes, told me that, well, they're still digging. So right away, it seemed like something was a little bit funny. And then as the night went on, it just seemed like the story just got more and more elaborate. There was talk that Frida was, in fact, under a granite table and with really strong iron legs, and that's what saved her. And she had been in contact with as many as five students. And then there was also that rescue workers were able to thread a hose through the rubble to get to her and give her water and milk. And everyone was expecting there to be a rescue. And part of it, too, was that there was just this all these camera images, these great visuals of the rescuers going into this pancake building and heroically looking for this girl. And it also fit a nice narrative of hope at a time when, you know, Mexico City was suffering such heartache from the earthquake, and there was this week, and there was an earthquake 12 days before that. It just seemed like, you know, this could be a symbol of hope, and it just all went for naught.
Yeah. So you were actually there, but you couldn't get close enough to see whether or not these things were actually happening. These tubes of water and milk being
sent down to her. Yeah, that's right. Nobody got close enough for exacting coverage. I should say the media, I mean, the camera coverage was quite robust. It was covered quite well visually, and I think that's part of what fed the narrative. And I think, too, it was also too good a story for some to pass up. There's, you know, Mexico's big broadcasters jumped on it. This is a country known for its telenovelas, and this, you know, a lot of people have been sort of saying, well, it sort of fit the pattern.
So did the American broadcasters, the CNNs of the world, did they get that information from the Mexican broadcasters?
It's very likely. I mean, they were also talking to some of the same people, though, at the site. I mean, for example, people would come out and we would talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the American broadcasters possibly were not as quick to pick up on some of the signs that looked a little, that told me, as somebody that's lived and covered Mexico for 12 years, you know, when one of the rescue brigades left, it was just sort of assumed, well, they'll be replaced. And I was like, well, wait a second here. Why are they leaving and this girl's not rescued yet? Something just seemed weird. And then when they said, is there a girl alive? They responded, they said they thought there were four students. And they wouldn't say whether they were alive. They didn't know. The other part was, where were the families?
Yeah.
That just seems sort of strange that usually, you know, the reporters that got there right away, sort of the night before or the night before, were able to see the parents and capture the angst of it. So,
right.
When what happened was late Wednesday night, Aurelio Nuñez, the public education secretary, came out and said that all the girls named Frida in the school were accounted for. So now the question everybody has is, how soon did they know this? How soon did the public education secretariat, who with the Navy and the local borough government were responsible for this rescue, when did they know that? That's the question we don't have an answer to. So it's very possible that this information was known and not released, and the Mexican and international media just kept running with it.
And once again, there really is no Frida there at all.
No,
just a made-up name.
Not at all. Made-up name.
Okay.
We don't know what this person was thinking, the person that came up with. And we haven't even identified who was the original person to state that name.
Well, meanwhile, are rescue efforts still continuing?
Yeah, yes, they are. I've been in Tlalpan in southern Mexico City, where a four-story apartment block has collapsed. And what we found... What happened this morning around 11, there was a loud cheer that went up. They said that there was a woman they're trying to rescue, and they had some signs of life. They didn't release details exactly what they had. This woman, you know, maybe it was knocking or yelling or crying, but they do believe they have at least one person. There's one person alive in there who's showing signs of life, and there's possibly eight that are unaccounted for. And so, you know, you have a rescue effort going on here at the moment, and that's sort of become the new compelling story. But this woman, it's thought that she was on the fourth floor of a four-story building, and it's collapsed, and they're not, you know, 30. She's relative, say 35 years old. They don't really know where she is, and it's also very fragile, the site, so it's just going so slow.
All right,
this rescue.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
That's David Agron. He's a contributing writer to The Guardian, and he's based in Mexico City. Coming up, it is movie time. Our critics review the latest, including yet another Lego movie.
This feels like more of a cynical, shameless cash grab than maybe the previous films were. They were more artful in disguising it, perhaps.
Plus, Bobby Riggs versus Billie Jean King and a Lady Gaga documentary next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Friday, time for movie reviews. And this is usually where I say it's time for much needed break from reality. Guess what? It's time for a much needed break from reality. We have a Lego movie coming out today and a few others. Christy Lemire is here. She's co-host of What the Flick on YouTube. Welcome back.
Hello.
And joining us is Russ Fisher, editor-in-chief of MoviePilot.com. Welcome to you.
Hello.
Okay, first up, Kingsman, The Golden Circle. This is the second in the franchise. It stars Colin Firth and Taron Egerton.
Welcome to Statesman.
As your American cousins, we'll be working side by side.
Let's get started.
We've got brains, skills, skipping rope.
It's a lasso.
I feel like I'm in a music video.
Well, this movie pretty much is like a 2 hour and 21 minute long music video. So that would be apropos. Yeah, I'm not sure the world was clamoring for a Kingsman sequel.
But I did like the first one.
I liked a lot about the first one, except for that one really grody shootout scene in the church that left kind of a bad taste. Mm. This is lighter and cheekier than the first. I actually like this one better than the first. And a lot of that has to do with Julianne Moore playing a villain, a really unusual opportunity for her to do comedy, which she does not get to do often enough. And she's a villain and she's having a blast here. It's just big, empty, stylish violence.
Okay.
It's fun.
Fun? Is it worth a 2 hour plus ride?
No. I did not have fun with this movie.
You didn't?
No, not at all. It's ugly, for one. It's excessively digital. Like, these movies kind of want to be an inheritor to the James Bond franchise, I think. But this one isn't a globe-hopping thing. It looks like it's all shot on a soundstage, and it's digital and just kind of thin and crappy looking.
Oh.
But to me, it was also a really poor attempt at, like, satire. That's this whole idea of trying to say that, like, morality is not inherently related to class. But what you get is this super bizarre mashup of stereotypes and stuff that to me didn't really end up amounting to anything besides a bunch of stylized violence.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be an indictment of the war on drugs.
It is, very much so. Supposed
oh, really?
To be.
How so?
You know, not to give too much away, there's a whole plot about how Julianne Moore's character is a drug kingpin, and she has essentially taken such control over the world's drug supply that she's able to manipulate users and basically turn them into a giant pool of ransom demands waiting to be paid. Mm. And the government of the U.S. isn't really into doing that.
Okay. And so is it the case that the hapless Brits need the strong Americans to help them out?
Yes. They kind of need each other. They kind of all realize that they need to team up and help each other. And so you get double the cast of huge name stars. And so you have Channing Tatum and Halle Berry and Jeff Bridges very briefly. And, you know, they're all having a laugh. It's all kind of a big, goofy, nutty thing. And although there is not a Big Lebowski reunion, I'm sad to say. You have Julianne Moore and Jeff Bridges, but never at the same time. That is the true
and
shame.
And no inside jokes?
None at all. No.
And there's one superstar singer who has a very fun cameo in this. I will say that. That's amusing. I will say that.
That's maybe the most consistent.
Do you want us to tell you?
Yes.
It's Elton John.
Oh, okay. All right.
It's in a week where Rocketman became a big thing, it's really appropriate.
He's kind of a supporting star in this week's news.
Indeed,
so.
Yeah. He also factors into another movie we'll speak about today.
Okay. Well, let's move on to Lego Ninjago. I think, Christy, that's how you say it.
Yep.
You would know because you have...
I have an eight-year-old son.
A little one. All right. Here's a clip from that.
So when you guys got together, was Dad always an evil warlord?
Okay, well, here it is. I got swept up. He had so many plans. He was so ambitious. He said he wanted to conquer the world. It must have been love. I thought it was a figure of speech.
Boy's dad is an evil warlord terrorizing the Lego world.
Yeah.
And
so this is based on a TV show called Ninjago. I'm sorry, Masters of Spinjitzu. It's on Cartoon Network. And it's, you know, on brand with other Lego properties. Like, it's cheeky and self-referential and self-aware and pop culture-y. If you are a fan of the TV show, as the young man living in my house happens to be, you'll be disappointed because it's nothing really like it. It's really more about Lloyd Garmadon and his father, you know, voiced by Justin Theroux, Lord Garmadon, and they have issues. They're estranged and they try to reconnect. Like all Lego movies, there's a daddy issue plot going on here. And it's really about them, and they have recast all the actors who do the voices in the TV show to do, you know, Camille Nanjiani and Zach Woods and Fred Armisen, and they get nothing to do. There's massive diminishing returns with these Lego movies. The first two were a blast. This feels like selling product. It's not
well,
good.
It is called a Lego movie.
I know, but this feels like more of a cynical, shameless cash grab than maybe the previous films were. They were more artful in disguising it, perhaps.
All right, now to a couple of based-on-real-life event movies. First, Battle of the Sexes. This stars Emma Stone as Billie Jean King, the tennis legend, and Steve Carell as Bobby Riggs, the washed-up tennis legend, based on their real-life spectacle. Here's a clip.
I could beat Billie Jean King.
Does she have the nerve?
Call Bobby. Tell him it's on.
So, Billie Jean, what do you want?
Now, don't get me wrong. I love women in the bedroom and in the kitchen.
What are you talking, Bobby? The more nonsense you spell, the worse it's going to be when you lose.
Okay, Russ, there's your Elton John.
There it is.
All right, set this up. It's 1973. Billie Jean is at the top of the world. She's a great tennis player. And
she's won the Grand Slam. And basically, she wants women tennis players to be paid as much as men. And the guy who runs the association that controls the whole tennis league does not want to give in. He's played by Bill Pullman in a semi-villainous turn. Mm-hmm. He's like more of a kind of old guy scumbag than a real villain, but it's nice to see him
mustache
in that.
Mustache twisting, cigar chomping, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that sort of thing. A real boardroom, men's club sort of guy. And so Billie Jean basically begins her own women-only tennis league, and they go on a sort of country-spanning tournament schedule. And meanwhile, we've got Bobby Riggs, played by Steve Carell, and he's kind of really washed up. He's having a lot of personal problems. He's got a gambling thing, leads to friction with his wife. And so he decides he wants to basically have a match against Billie Jean King. And that leads to a whole setup of this Battle of the Sexes, as it's called.
And it's just a spectacle, correct?
It is a spectacle, but also what's happening in Billie Jean King's personal life is that she's falling in love with her hairdresser, played by Andrea Riseborough, and so she has to hide this previously untapped lesbian inside of herself for fear of losing sponsorships, for fear of being ostracized. It was 1973. Mm-hmm. The world might not have been ready for this then.
And so, she's married.
And she's also oh, married to a guy. So this works better for me as a romance than as a sports biopic kind of film. It's surprisingly safe and restrained for a movie about a woman who is so groundbreaking and who is so tough and so fearless. This movie, it feels kind of paint by numbers, like safe, formulaic, restrained, tasteful, well acted, but just I wanted more punch.
We do.
But the match itself is staged excitingly, you know, and they're both actors are really, really good in it. Emma Stone's great in it, but I was disappointed.
I agree. The romance is great. I mean, the two of them, it achieves some real intimacy in these scenes between Billie Jean and her lover, and those scenes are tremendous, and they feel like they really get into something that the rest of the movie completely avoids.
I mean, what about the resonance with kind of a reawakening of feminism that's happening now? Does that give the movie a sharper point?
I think this movie plays that far too large. It continually hammers home this point of that there is a battle between the sexes of these differences. It does so with no subtlety in a way that is a bit cringe-inducing for me.
At the same time, they make Bobby Riggs kind of adorable, like this adorable scamp rogue. Like, they want us to like him, but he probably wasn't a good dude, you know, and in this setting, he definitely wasn't a good guy.
I think what's interesting in this context is that it's seeing them go at it in this battle verbally before their match, they're genial in a way that seems impossible now. And these things where we're so divided into partisan sides at this point, it's very difficult to see this conflict playing out the same way today. And so the movie is both a little bit, it almost seems naive in a way, because now we're so polarized and so fractured.
Well, we did just go through that election.
Exactly.
So there are
exactly.
some parallels there. Okay. Next we have Stronger. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal as Jeff Bowman. He's a real life victim of the Boston Marathon bombing. He lost both of his legs as he watched from the sidelines.
You're trying to make a hero out of me.
You need to tell your family what's going on with you. Take my mom, take my
mom.
I can't do this. I can't do it.
This is the first time you're in this week and you had 3 appointments.
You just have to show up.
Show up! I showed up for you!
Ooh, that's heavy going, Christy.
So this is sort of the opposite of Battle of the Sexes in that it looks formulaic. On paper, it looks like a feel-good, inspirational, true story. And it's a lot grittier and more emotionally resonant than that. And a lot of that has to do with the script. A lot of that has to do with David Gordon Green, who directed it, who would seem like an unlikely choice for this kind of material. But that understated tone that he brings to movies like All the Real Girls or Joe or Prince Avalanche, that understatement brings a grounding to the material that makes it really much more powerful. Jake Gyllenhaal is great in this. Visually, this is a really impressive film because it's a lot more visual effects than we get from David Gordon Green's films, like with the amputation that Jeff Bowman had to undergo. Like it looks seamless. It's very effective. And great performances from Jake Gyllenhaal and Tatiana Maslany as his then girlfriend, the woman he was going to see at the finish line on the day of the marathon. And no, it's good. The Boston family and friends are a little over the top and kind of like a Goodwill Hunting parody kind of way.
And Miranda Richardson as the kind of alcoholic mom.
Kind of over the top, like blousy working class Boston mom. But yeah, I was surprised at how emotionally powerful this was.
I will say I teared up at the trailer.
It's well done.
Yeah, it definitely gets you.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to a documentary about pop star Lady Gaga. It's on Netflix. It's called Gaga 5'2".
What happened in the last 5 years? Real fans probably knew deep down that there was something going on.
Paranoia, fear, body pain, anxiety.
I go from everyone touching me all day and talking at me all day to total silence. And all these people will leave, and then I'll be alone.
All right, Russ, what did you think of this?
I like this movie a lot. And I'm not all that tied into Lady Gaga, so I don't come to this as a fan of hers exactly. But it's a really interesting documentary about the isolation of fame, as that clip suggests, and about trying to kind of really come into yourself. You know, as we come into this film with her, she's already at the top of her game, but she's feeling a lot of, she doesn't really have a romantic partner who is there for her. She's surrounded by all these people. As you hear, she's being touched all the time, but she feels very isolated, it seems. At the same time, she's also realizing that she has a lot of artistic power and a lot of personal power, and she's figuring out ways to put that to work in her life and her music and in the world around her. And this is kind of a brief portrait of basically a year in her life that captures all of those personal problems and evolutions in a really intimate and touching way.
Yeah, she's in the middle of recording and promoting the Joanne album, which was a departure for her musically, which is very personal for her. She's getting ready to do the Super Bowl halftime show, so it's a big time for her. And this is a very intimate documentary. It's not necessarily warts and all. I mean, she makes herself very, very vulnerable, but whatever she's doing, if she's crying because of physical pain, you know, if she is demanding of her background dancers or whatever, it's always on message. Like, this is a woman who is confident and capable, and she knows who she is, and she's singular. And watching her record that album, just her voice, like, isolated, it is so powerful. She's such an amazing singer. I would like to have actually seen more performances in the film.
I agree with that. Yeah, her voice is really striking. It really stands out. And to your point about watching her as she's going through pain and crying, there's always a degree where I wonder how calculated this is and how much she's really, where she's conscious of the image she's putting across for this film, where she's really being open and vulnerable. In the end, I don't think it matters. In the end, I think that all kind of wraps up into being a pop star, being someone who's famous. And that's the underlying current of a lot of this movie.
And the fans love her for it.
They do. And there's a really neat montage where, as you're talking about with this film, you know, she kind of stripped down her image. She goes to this, she says she wants to have a uniform. So she's got these like super cropped white t-shirts and these jean shorts, as opposed to like wearing a meat dress or wearing these outlandish costumes that she was really known for. And there's this montage of her sort of greeting fans in this stripped down uniform, cut against her greeting fans in all of these different crazy costumes that we know her from, and seeing there's really no difference in impact. She's still being received by fans rapturously, and she's still extremely important to her fans, and they are very important to her as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think what's interesting about her is she has really captured this otherness, this vulnerability of the outsider, of the other, of the bullied kid who has really glommed onto her and her identity, however crafted it may be.
Yeah, and whether you like her or her music, I think you walk away from this film with an appreciation of her as an artist, as a person.
Mm-hmm. I know, I'm always suspicious of these after the Katy Perry one and even Truth or Dare with Madonna.
This reminds me of that.
Uh-huh. And this references Madonna very, so, yes. Like her rivalry or relationship to Madonna is a significant part of this film. She says at one point that she's upset that Madonna has sort of taken shots at her. And she's like, I really want Madonna to just kind of throw me up against the wall and kiss me and tell me I'm a horrible person. And it's an interesting articulation of like how she wants that conflict to play out.
Huh. Interesting. Well, Madonna did make out with Britney Spears, so
yes,
there is hope.
And this
her.
Is on Netflix, by the way. The Gaga documentary is on Netflix if you want to just watch it from the comfort of your home.
Just right. Turn it up loud.
Okay. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Russ Fisher, film critic and editor-in-chief of MoviePilot.com, and Christy Lemire, film critic and co-host of What the Flick on YouTube.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to talk about North Korea trading insults with President Trump. And really, North Korea has a history of some pretty elaborate insults. Most recently, Kim Jong-un called President Trump a, quote, mentally deranged U.S. dotard, or is it dotard? That has led to some confusion, since it's a word most people haven't heard since maybe the 14th century. Well, we've assembled a panel of insult experts to help us decode some of the many snubs North Korea has lobbed in recent years. Ginny Chung is a comedian and improv actor here in L.A. Hi.
Hello. How are you doing?
Great. And Guy Nicolucci is a writer for Comedy Central Roast. Hi there.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great. Okay, we're going to play kind of a ratings game with these. I'm going to give you a North Korean insult, and you guys rate it on a scale of 1 for lame to 10 for fire, for how hard it burns. And let's start with dotard. So that means a state or period of senile decay marked by decline of mental poise and alertness. That's the official definition from the dictionary. And Ginny?
If we are allowed to say all of those words, then I would say that's a 9 at least, because just the way that's positioned is perfect for me.
A 9.
So I would say a 9, yeah.
Yeah, that's, wow, okay. What do you think, Guy?
I give it a 0. If I don't understand what it means, then it doesn't work.
But now
that's
that you
true.
Now that you understand, what would you give it?
5. Again, I hate to work, and that one made me work.
Which, again, even dotard is very antiquarian. It's very 1930s constable sounding to me, and also like Shakespearean at the same time. So I keep thinking about cracking open an old book and seeing dotard. Maybe that's what is tickling my gut right now.
Well, my thing is, I think he's got his Google Translate set from 1832 is the problem. And he's putting in Korean words, and they're coming out of his, you know, his Tandy Pro MacBook from whatever. And it's just kind of like, as opposed to like feeling the hurt, feeling the burn, you just stop and go, that's an interesting choice of words.
It's just like when in ninth grade I used this thesaurus for problem, and then it came up with exigency, which I then used in my term paper.
Okay, so I'm going to throw then Donald Trump's at you that he called Kim Jong-un, and that is Rocket Man. What do you rate that one?
I rate that a 0, actually. That to me is very lazy. Rocket Man, there's something very childlike about that, but not a smart kid. Just always like, Rocket, man, I hear a stuttering behind it.
Guy?
I would rate it pretty low, but I'm going to rate it higher because I'm impressed that it's clear that he's writing his own stuff.
Okay.
So given that he's a 70-year-old dotard, that's not bad.
Fair enough.
Okay. All right. Kim Jong-un also compared Trump to a frightened dog and called him a rogue and a gangster fond of playing with fire. What do you think of those insults? They seemed a little more easily read, Guy.
Well, I know that Kim actually went to school in Switzerland, so it sounds like they were translated from the Swiss, which means to me that I give him a nothing. It's just a bunch of words. I give it a one.
You give it a one, Ginny.
I actually agree with that. It is a bunch of words. It's a little floppy, and also I'm just noticing a pattern of dog hate with Kim Jong-un.
Oh, really?
Across the board. Yeah, there's frightened dog, and also I think North Korea had said about a week ago something about us that we should be beaten to death like a rabid dog, and that's, man, why all this xenophobia? What's going on here?
Well, he did describe John Kerry as a wolf with a hideous lantern jaw, and I guess wolves are dogs of some sort. So I think you're right there. All right.
Yeah.
He once said, here's another one, for George W. Bush when he was president, he called him a chicken soaked in rain. Ginny, it sounds like you like that one.
Well, I don't like it. Chicken does imply to me a wussiness and also just a chicken with a head cut off sort of running rampant. So in that case, yes, but wet chicken, that's also a little floppy to me, I think. It's a little easy.
A little easy, huh? So you'd give it what?
I'd give it a two,
I guess. Wow, okay. He's not doing so well. Guy?
I'd give it a three. I mean, I actually like chicken. I mean, eating it. But wet chicken at least puts a smell in my nose.
All right. He said Hillary Clinton, quote, looks like a primary schoolgirl and sometimes a pensioner going shopping.
Pensioner going shopping is pretty funny. I would have to give that an eight, actually. Sorry, AARP. But that to me is pretty funny.
Guy?
Well, the fact is, the person, she sometimes looks like a schoolgirl, then contradicts that she looks like a pensioner going shopping. She's undercutting its own premise. I give it a five, Dave.
All right. Finally, we're going to talk about Dick Cheney, whom he described as a most cruel monster and bloodthirsty beast.
So where's the insult?
Just a truth bomb, that's all.
This is NPR. We're supposed to be crazy liberal, right?
Is that the winner?
Well, that's just telling the truth, I suppose.
What if you mashed them all up and did a crafty dotard soaked in rain?
Wow, that sounds like a 70s song by James Taylor.
I think he'd be up to sing that, James Taylor. I think so.
All right. Well, we had Elton John this week, so why not? Let's add in another 70s singer.
Himself.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you both. That was great. Thanks for playing the game.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Madeline.
Ginny Chung, comedian and improv actor here in L.A. Guy Nicolucci, writer for Comedy Central Roasts.
There is a young cowboy, lives on the range. His horse and his cattle, they're his only companions. He works in the saddle and he sleeps in the canyons, just waiting for summer.
Okay, a little James Taylor for you there. We also have a Twitter poll up for the best insult. Dotard is tied with chicken soaked in rain. Wolf with hideous lantern jaw, only at 14%. You can weigh in at KCRW Press Play. Hey, have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.